seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 060418 H.C. Beck Limited versus Charles Rice.
Court, Mr. Weiner will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm David Weiner, counsel for H.C. Beck Limited. Together, here with me today is co-counsel for Beck, Mr. Peter Martin. Also in attendance is Ms. Lynn Hughes, who is the co-author of the brief for the insurance amici. I believe that this case can be described in a nutshell. The construction contract between the owner and H.C. Beck required that all of the subcontractors enroll in the owner-controlled insurance program, which I'll refer to as the OSIP. The written agreement between Beck, the general contractor, and Haley Greer, the subcontractor, incorporated all of the provisions of the construction contract, and it spelled out in particular that the insurance coverage was going to be furnished under the OSIP, and in addition directed Haley Greer as to what it needed to do to obtain the coverage under the OSIP. Haley Greer did indeed enroll in the OSIP. It was issued an individual workers' compensation policy. That policy was paid for, the premiums for that policy were paid for by the owner. Mr. Rice was injured on the job, and he obtained benefits under the workers' compensation policy. Under these facts, H.C. Beck should be considered the statutory employer or the deemed employer of Haley Greer and its subcontractors and entitled to immunity under Section 406.123 of the Labor Code because it had a written agreement with the subcontractor in which it provided workers' compensation coverage to the subcontractor and its employees.
Does that mean that if we look at an oil field contract where the contractors are required to provide workers' compensation and give a certificate to the operator, that operator has provided workers' compensation because they've contractually required it and required proof of that comp? And if not, how does that differ from your situation?
Well, I understand that there are differences with respect to those oil field situations.
Let's talk about any. Let's talk about the maintenance in a building. If you have a maintenance, a large company that's contracted several buildings and to maintain, and then they do subcontracts, and they require that subcontractor doing a particular building contractually to provide workers' compensation for their employees and to provide a certificate to the general contractor that has been provided.
Well, it would not be provided under the scenario that you're describing.
How does that differ from yours is what I'm wondering. You have a contractual requirement, so how does that differ from yours?
It differs because in the case before the court today, the owner purchased the policy and paid the premium, whereas, as I understand the scenario that you're describing, Justice Johnson, it would be the subcontractor who was simply required to purchase and have workers' compensation insurance for the job. In fact, the argument that Mr. Rice has made throughout these appellate proceedings is that taking the position that simply requiring the subcontractor to have workers' compensation insurance is sufficient to trigger the statute and the immunity under the statute. And that is not our position, because the way that this mechanism was designed here, Haley Greer, the subcontractor, did not pay the premium. It was the owner who obtained and furnished the policy. It was the owner who, as I say, paid the premium for the policy And Haley Greer didn't have the responsibility for going out and obtaining its own workers' compensation insurance and paying for the premium. Part of the mechanism here in the OSIP was that the subcontractor, as part of the enrollment process, and in fact, the very heart of the enrollment process, was to submit the information to the insurance representative of the owner with respect to the cost of its workers' compensation insurance that it would then be required to deduct from its contract price. That's exactly what happened here. So that they had the cost savings that was reflected in reducing its contract price with the general contractor and with the owner.
But your position in all of this was simply a contractual requirement that the sub provide workers' comp.
Again, it's not that the sub provide the workers' comp.
Your position was a contractual requirement.
It was a contractual requirement that the sub enroll in the owner-controlled insurance program, which includes the general liability insurance as well as the workers' compensation insurance. And that's what Haley Greer did. It enrolled in that program, and it had its workers' compensation policy purchased for it by the owner of the project, FMR. Now, the reason that we contend that the general contractor, that's Beck, is entitled to immunity under the statute is that it was part of its subcontract with Haley Greer, its written agreement with Haley Greer, that Haley Greer enroll in that owner-controlled insurance program. The courts that have addressed the question of the meaning of provide, and really the central question in this case is whether the what Beck did in this case constituted providing within the meaning of the statute, have held that it doesn't matter how the insurance was provided to the subcontractor. All that really matters is that there was a workers' compensation policy that was in force,
and
there was.
You concede provide does not mean ordered the sub to pay for it.
Correct. And in fact, that's probably the crucial point, is that there's some kind of arrangement or some kind of mechanism under which the subcontractor is relieved of having to pay for it.
The brief seemed to suggest that your client did not reduce their price to reflect that they weren't having to pay for workers' comp either.
Well, I think the Court of Appeals said in its opinion that Beck did not reduce its contract price, but the state of the record is that it does not reflect one way or the other. However, I think that
when Beck entered the contract, they knew they weren't going to have to pay for the insurance.
Correct. But they weren't going to have to pay for their insurance, and they weren't going to have to pay for the subcontractor's insurance because, with respect to the owner,
infer from that their price was reduced.
Yes, in fact, if you look and you can see that there's a certificate in the record of the coverage for Beck as well as certificates for the coverage for the subcontractor, Haley Greer. In order to get to that point, they had to have enrolled in the process in the owner-controlled insurance program. The record simply just doesn't contain the enrollment papers with respect to Beck. So the Court of Appeals in this case, of course, disagreed that Beck was entitled to immunity, that it was a statutory or deemed employer, holding that what Beck did not constitute providing the workers' compensation coverage within the meaning of the statute. Now let's look, if we can, at the two lines of reasoning that the Court of Appeals laid out for in supporting that holding. The first of those lines of reasoning was that the owner-controlled insurance program, the OSIP, was optional on the part of the owner, that it was up to the owner to not offer the OSIP, that it could have terminated the OSIP at any time. And the answer to that we have submitted is that the Court of Appeals should not have been concerned with what might have happened under the OSIP, but only what actually did happen. And what actually did happen was that it furnished the owner the OSIP, that Haley Greer and all the subcontractors enrolled in the OSIP, that there was a policy that Mr. Rice here obtained benefits under the policy. So what might have happened is simply irrelevant to the state of the to the facts in this case. The interesting thing, in a sense, is if the court were to ever consider what might have happened had the OSIP not been in place on this job, is that the Court of Appeals clearly misread the OSIP as far as the alternative insurance provision. The Court of Appeals said that under the OSIP, if the owner decided not to furnish the OSIP, or if it decided at some point to terminate it, that Haley Greer would have been required to provide or to pay for its own workers' compensation insurance. But that's clearly not what the alternative insurance provision in the OSIP says. What it says is that if something like that were to happen, then the general contractor, Beck, would be required to purchase the workers' compensation insurance, and that it would be at the owner's expense. So, again, even though the court need not reach that alternative ground, because the focus really should be on what actually did happen in this case, but if the court were for some reason to address that in any way, the only conclusion that really could be drawn here is that Haley Greer, the subcontractor, was never going to be required to bear the expense of the workers' compensation coverage. The OSIP itself, even in saying that the OSIP might not be applicable, guaranteed that that coverage was going to be purchased at somebody other than the subcontractor's expense. The second ground that the...
Why is this an owner-provided program as opposed to a general contractor-provided program?
Well, it was that there are those two kinds of wrap-up programs, the OSIP, the owner-controlled insurance program, and the CSIP, the contractor-controlled insurance program. It appears that in one of the cases that has addressed these kinds of arrangements, that's the ET case from the Court of Appeals, there was a contractor-controlled insurance program that in its structure is essentially the same. Now, whether it originates with the owner or it happens to originate with the general contractor really should make no difference in the result as far as the immunity that's extended to the general contractor.
Does the owner get any immunity as for having an OSIP as opposed to a CSIP?
Well, there's no question that the owner would have the immunity. In fact, that's essentially what was decided recently by the court in the Entergy Gulf States case. The owner can in effect stand in the shoes of the general contractor, and that's a completely logical and sensible result, because it's the owner who is procuring the work on the site, and that's certainly what happens in a project like this. It's the owner who initiates everything and procures the work on the site, working through the general contractor, of course. The second ground that our second line of reasoning that the Court of Appeals engaged in here was to say that, well, Beck really did here was to require the subcontractor, Haley Greer, to apply for this coverage. And we don't think that requiring them to apply for the coverage is sufficient to establish that they provided the coverage.
Well, if the alternative insurance provision was as the Court of Appeals read it. I understand you agree that they misinterpreted the provision. But if, in fact, the contracts required the sub to go out and get its own and pay for its own insurance if the owner control program didn't approve the sub, then you wouldn't have any quibble with the CA opinion, right?
Well, again, in a different circumstance, I understand that the argument
instance,
would have to be different.
In that instance, the contractor wouldn't have provided anything.
Well, he wouldn't have provided because the bottom line is that if the subcontractor had to pay for its own workers' compensation insurance, it really, in all likelihood, could not be said that the general contractor provided it. What matters is more than anything.
The cases have said payment is not so much the indicia, but I mean, if Beck had required the subcontractor to go out and get its own insurance, regardless of who paid for it, would that be a different? Would that change your mind?
Yes, because what Mr. Rice has said is that that's what our position. Our position is that requiring the subcontractor to go out and get workers' compensation policy entitles the general contractor to immunity, and that's not what our position is. Our position is that that Beck provided the insurance in this case because it had the written agreement, because it specified and it required that the subcontractor obtain that insurance through the OSIP, and what is crucial is that under that OSIP, the premium was paid for by someone other than the subcontractor who was going to get the coverage.
I guess what I'm saying, though, is presume that the OSIP requires payment by the owner, and the sub doesn't applies and is not approved. And presume the OSIP then said that the sub has got to go get its own insurance, but the owner will pay for it. In that event, Beck would have done nothing to provide insurance, right? It didn't have to go out and secure an alternate person, nor did it pay a premium.
Well, I don't think that really is any different than a scenario under which Beck might have directly purchase the comp insurance for the subcontractor and said, subcontractor Haley Greer, you have to enroll in this program. But they submit their enrollment papers, and the insurance representative determines, as your scenario suggests, that for some reason they're not going to cover them. So they've got to go out and secure that insurance from somebody else, but it remains the responsibility of Beck to pay for the premium. I think that would be sufficient to establish
now,
providing.
No, the owner paid for the premium, and the sub had to go out and get.
Well, again, it's the same thing, but it relates to the second argument that the second ground that the Court of Appeals invoked here for saying that Beck had not provided it, and that is that all there was a requirement of an application. But it wasn't just an application. It was an enrollment procedure. And that's not going to be any different. The mechanism that was in place here is not any different from any other underwriting situation where the subcontractor has to enroll, and the insurance representative or the insurer makes the ultimate decision on whether to provide the insurance. If you had the backup that you're describing and saying, well, they got rejected in the enrollment process and they had to go out and get it somewhere else, and it was being paid for by the owner, or if it was dealing directly with Beck, I think that would be sufficient to establish providing.
It would be.
Yes.
Just even though you wouldn't have done anything.
Well, but I think they would have done something, which is that they would have required them to participate in the program if they could establish their eligibility, which, as a practical matter, is what does happen. They do establish their eligibility.
Other questions? Thank you, Councilman. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Boudloge will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. This is a contractual interpretation case. I'm not here challenging the statute, and I'm not here challenging the holdings of Williams versus Brown and Root. Simply stated, I'm not here to destroy the Texas economy, as seems to be suggested by the amicus briefs. I do believe that if there is a properly constructed OSIP program, that the general contractor has immunity under 406.123. My position is that this is not a properly constructed OSIP program, and that a general contractor, and in particular H.C. Beck, cannot cloak themselves with immunity by simply calling a contract an OSIP program and say that this statute should apply.
Well, it seems to me so much of the argument boils down to the interpretation of the alternate insurance clause.
Yes, ma'am.
And if your interpretation of that clause is wrong, if under that alternate insurance clause, in fact, H.C. Beck had to go out and get insurance if the sub wasn't approved, that the owner would then pay for, does your argument fall?
I would agree with counsel on that. But I believe that if there's a proper interpretation of that statute, of that provision, you would see that it is Hallie Greer, Mr. Rice's employer, actually would have to go out and purchase that policy.
So you're the distinction in your case is the one clause that said if the owner cancels the workers' comp, you, the sub, have to go get it.
Yes, sir. Because the statute says that there has to be a written agreement, right, and that written agreement means, you know, that they are to provide the workers' compensation.
It has to be a written agreement to provide insurance.
Correct. And under this,
but they did. Insurance was provided.
Insurance was provided. Now, here my argument is that this is because of the optional nature of this program. You know, what the general contractor wants in this is to say, you know, we're kind of tippy-toeing into this. We can provide it, but if for any reason we can cut out any subcontractor or any lower-tier subcontractor, you know, indiscriminately. And the basic premise of a written contract is that there's legal obligations.
But does the workers' comp statute or the program put any limit on that, like a notice period, or can you just, you know, drop them at 2 in the afternoon and so for the rest of the day they're bare, or how does it?
The statute has no notice provision or no specific limitations. My argument here, Your Honor, is that there is an overall construction contract for a period of time. Now, what they're saying is inside this construction contract is that we're having this OSIP program. And for a period of time, we're going to provide OSIP to all the subcontractors. But if at any point any one of the subcontractors' risk expectations are become too high that we want to drop them out of the program, we can do so. That subcontractor at that point has no rights, no remedies against the general contractor to say, wait a minute, you are to provide this.
I'm trying to figure out why an owner would do that. Said, we've got somebody working on the site who's doing real dangerous things, so therefore we're going to get rid of our insurance so that when one of your guys dies, he'll sue us for a bunch. Why would they ever do that?
Well, okay, you know, first, Your Honor, this, what they're going to do is they're looking at the economies of scale, and this is what was argued in the AMICA briefs. The general contractor is going to take in the various subcontractors, and premiums are based upon the risks that, you know, are come about by that subcontractor.
If you've got a risky subcontractor, you're going to fire them. You're not going to just decide to leave them on the job and we'll take care of any injuries ourselves. You're not going to get rid of your insurance. You're going to get rid of the sub, aren't you?
Not necessarily. I mean, certain, you know, construction occupations are very high risk, and there's going to be, you know, some you know, incidences that may occur.
Which is why you want workers' comp insurance.
Which is why you want workers' compensation insurance.
Out why the fact that it's optional, I can't imagine a scenario where they would cancel it.
Well, there could be any number of...
When would it be in their economic interest to drop the workers' comp coverage?
When the premiums, when they can shift that premium off of themselves, off of the general contractor, to the subcontractor, and say, subcontractor, we want you to, you know, still carry comp, but you're going to pay
they
that.
They get rid of the premium. The premium is always less than the lawsuit, though.
Well...
If people wouldn't get it.
Here it doesn't matter because the owner's going to pay the premium anyway.
No, Your Honor. I disagree with counsel on that.
Okay.
This case is that the premium is being paid by the owner, but is being financed by Halley Greer because they have to cut their price for the job to be able to participate into the program. In fact, even on the same page that we have the alternate insurance agreement that we're talking about, just above that shows the final insurance cost calculations, the final calculations of what the subcontractor has to take off of his bid price to finance the premium that the owner is paying.
That's not illegal or anything, is it?
No, you're right.
That's the way it always works.
I would imagine so under an OSIP program, yes. But, I mean, but it still means that Halley Greer is funding the premium.
And this may be a simplistic way to read this statute, but what's the purpose of it? It seems to me that the purpose is, the object is to make sure that employees on the site are covered by workers' compensation insurance. And if that is done, what does the legislature really care whether it's done by the owner through this OSIP or done by the general contractor through a direct contract between it and the subcontractor?
Yes, sir.
I mean, here the employee received workers' comp insurance. So wasn't the purpose of the legislation satisfied?
No, Your Honor.
Tell me why not.
Okay.
I just don't understand.
Okay. Here, and I guess, you know, I'm showing my age because I came up doing old law workers' compensation, and I remember when the statute was originally passed in the 80s. Compensation provides for the employer an exemption if he buys compensation so that an injured employee, without regard to fault, receives compensation benefits, indemnity benefits, and medical benefits. It only applies to the employer. In this case, Halley Greer. Now, traditionally, if any third party out here that is not the employer, they're all subject to their workers' to common law liabilities. If the employer under workers' compensation chooses to go without buying workers' compensation, his penalty is that he loses his common law defenses.
Yes, but under this statute, by providing insurance to the employee, the general contractor becomes basically the statutory employer. So
what he's trying,
he's not literally, but the legislation is saying we're going to give this general contractor immunity as if they were the employer because the employees are being protected by coverage.
They are creating a fiction that the general contractor is the employer. They're creating this fiction so that it encourages a general contractor to provide workers' compensation for some subcontractors who may not be otherwise able to get workers' compensation.
And so that brings me back to my question. Why isn't that purpose satisfied here? The workers' compensation is being provided to the employee?
Because there's a big difference between a general contractor receiving the immunity under this statute and a real employer receiving immunity. Remember what I said. The real employer, if he doesn't have workers' compensation, his penalty is that he loses his common law defenses. Here, the general contractor, if he chooses not to have an OSIP program, he has no penalty. He still has his common law defenses. If this case gets remanded for some reason, and I go back, you know, and is remanded as ordered by the Court of Appeals, I got to go back there and fight a defense of an independent contractor. They don't lose that defense simply because they haven't provided workers' compensation.
Why not?
So there is a distinct difference.
Why wouldn't they lose that immunity if they didn't provide?
Because they're not an employer. They're only becoming a fictitious employer under this statute if they buy the compensation or provide the compensation under a written agreement. And that is why the statute is so specific in that it says you have to have a written agreement as opposed to something oral, and you have to provide workers' compensation, not just require workers' compensation. You have to go out and provide it. And what I'm saying is that provide means that they have to provide an underwriting outlet. They have to make sure that there is that subcontractor who may not be able to get compensation elsewhere can get compensation, that they have to, you know, actually make that provision. And the reason for that is if they don't do, you know, don't have those extra requirements in there, then they go back and they just have their common law defenses.
You don't want the subcontractor to be hanging out there.
No, ma'am.
And if they're not hanging out there, then they're covered. I mean, then the general contractor is immune and the owner's immune. Right? I mean, that's why I keep coming back to the alternate insurance clause, because really the question is, does this hang out the subcontractor or not in the event the owner doesn't provide the insurance?
Now, it does not do so, because what they are doing is turning around and saying, and HC Beck passes through to the subcontractor, that the subcontractor and lower tier subcontractors will be required to provide alternate insurance.
Well, and that's the question I have. The very next sentence defines what alternate insurance is. And it says alternate insurance is the coverage required by the contract documents if the OSIP is not enforced or doesn't apply. So the coverage required by the contract documents, if you don't qualify for the OSIP program, is that HC Beck go out and get the insurance.
I disagree with the court's interpretation, and I think this is a very fundamental issue and disagreement between the parties, and this is where it's contractual interpretation. If you follow that line of logic, then what is the purpose of the sentence above? The sentence above says the subcontractor and lower tier subcontractors will be required to provide alternate insurance. My interpretation is that that next sentence defines, as you say, what alternate insurance is. It is the coverage. The main contract says that you have to have coverage in certain limits of $1 million, workers' compensation, employers' B coverage of $1 million, general liability coverage of $1 million, over $300 million, whatever it is. What it is referring to is the limits, the coverage limits that are required. It doesn't say that HC Beck is going to go out and buy and pay for those policies. It's saying that otherwise you completely eliminate a whole sentence by your interpretation or by petitioner's interpretation of the case, saying that HC Beck is going to go out and provide it the policies if.
Well, that's what the OSIP provides. The OSIP says the construction manager shall secure the insurance.
Yes, and then they're getting.
And then the sub. Contract says alternate insurance is the coverage required by the OSIP. And so I can see.
No, ma'am. The main contract documents, and I realize, you know, it's a real thick book, and the whole record's up here, but in there it has an OSIP program in the contract documents, and then it has a provision, I believe it begins at 11.011 or something of this nature. What it says is if for any reason FMR cancels the OSIP program, then the general contractor is to go out and get the following coverages and the following limits, you know, telling them what they'd have to do. It'd be what you would have in a contract if you did not have an OSIP program. And then what I'm contending is that HC Beck then comes along with their subcontract and the alternate insurance provision that we have here and says, subcontractor, if they do cancel this, you know, you have to go out and get, you know, these various policies and these limits, because, you know, the limits are required and they're specified in the main contract. You know, otherwise you completely eliminate that above sentence. You know, which is that the subcontractor and the lower tier subcontractors will be required to provide the alternate insurance.
Do you agree with the Court of Appeals that it was not necessary that HC Beck actually pay for the coverage?
That is the holding of Williams versus Brown and Root.
You started out by saying you agreed with that.
I'm not here to argue payment. What I'm here to argue is that this contract, this was not a contract that provided workers' compensation. What I'm saying is that because of the optional nature of it, it was an illusory contract. You know, it gave the subcontractor no rights to force the general contractor to provide compensation. And then the second issue that I draft up in my brief is
provide. How do you provide unless somebody pays?
My argument with regards to how it's provided is that to get insurance, you have to have somebody that's willing to underwrite it. You know, H.C. Beck and FMR, they're not going to pay, they're not going to undertake the risk. What they're going to do is find somebody to undertake the risk. What I'm saying is that you provide it when you provide a, an underwriting outlet. Now, the limit of what is provided is, of course, going to be a subject of
the outlet, and nobody pays the premium. Is it provided?
No, but but that's subject to the contractual provisions.
These employees are not going to be covered unless someone pays the comp premium.
Sure, and the
separate payment from providing is.
What I'm saying is that the contract could say that the subcontractor is paying is to pay the premium. That we will provide you a policy, but we want you to pay the premium. Or, it can say you cut down your price on your job cost so that we'll, essentially funding it through us, and we'll be sure that the premium is paid. Or
they're promising to pay the premium. Sometimes people don't do what they promise.
Correct.
So how do you get the employees covered unless somebody actually pays? You're saying that they don't have to pay to provide comp for those employees?
No, Your Honor, because under a regular contract, construction contract, what you're going to have is you're going to have the general contractor telling the subcontractor that you must have workers' compensation. And the subcontractor then goes out and finds an underwriter, an insurance company that's going to write it. And then what he's going to do is he's going to, that subcontractor is going to pay the premium.
Okay, so it's provided when it's paid for. That's what I thought Justice Heck was asking about. The Court of Appeals doesn't – I thought you said that you're not – your position is not that it has to be paid for it in order to be provided.
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry. The Williams versus Brown and Root case, they rate the employee raised the argument that the premium was being paid for by his direct employer, not the general contractor. And in Williams versus Brandon Root, they said it doesn't matter who pays the premium. What is the real issue is whether or not compensation was provided by the general contractor. And that is what I was responding to Justice Hecht about.
And you agree with that? At least for purposes
of... For purposes of today, yes, Your Honor. that's not the issue that I'm raising at this point.
But your argument that it's not provided if it can be canceled, if it's optional, doesn't that add something to the statute? It just says you have to have a written agreement on which you'll provide it. It doesn't say a non-cancelable written agreement. And here we had a written agreement, and it was provided... So which part of provide says, and it has to be something that you can't cancel?
It's not in the provide part. It's in the written agreement part. Because a written agreement is a contract, and a contract has enforceable obligations.
Well, but if you hire a guy to mow your lawn, you could do that in writing, but that doesn't mean that you can't cancel it tomorrow.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So how come this kind of written agreement, how do we know this kind of written agreement has to be one you can't cancel?
What I'm saying is that you're as part of an overall construction contract. An overall construction contract goes from beginning to end. And what I'm saying is that during the period of that whole contract, if you're having an OSIP program, then you have to agree to provide it during that whole program. Now, if the whole contract, the whole construction contract, craters and they cancel the whole program, the whole contract, then you cancel it at that point.
Then wouldn't the statute have said you have to have a written agreement agreeing to provide for the whole program?
My interpretation of the statute is that's essentially what they're saying. Otherwise,
the statute said.
Otherwise, it becomes illusory, Judge. You know, they could bounce it out. You know, the
no, if everybody performs, and the illusory contract is still a contract, right? Illusory contract's just prospective. Once everybody performs, it's accepted by performance.
And since what you're trying to do is provide compensation benefits to, or prospectively to, the employees of subcontractors, if at any point during the overall construction project, you know, the owner, for whatever reason, for expense or otherwise, says, you know, I'm not going to afford you anymore, then it then shifts it back to the subcontractor. And what is the penalty for the general contractor if he does that? Nothing. He has his otherwise common law defenses. Now, if the subcontractor, the real employer, does that, he then loses his common law defenses.
Okay, let me very quickly, Jim, I don't, if in fact the owner says, well, I want the subcontractor to pay these costs now, pay the premium, does the sub get to add that back into its under the agreement, into the contract?
I'm hesitant to answer that, Judge, because I haven't gone back and analyzed that part of it. They, to be in the program, they did have to reduce their price.
So it makes sense that if you have to pay for it, then you should be able to. Whether the agreement covers that or not, you don't know.
It makes sense, but I can't. I don't want to represent something to the court.
And just a quick question: does Entergy versus Summers have any application here?
No, ma'am. I mean,
is that?
Because, I mean, it has no effect to the issues that I am bringing before this court. I realize it.
You're saying no because it hadn't been preserved, hadn't been.
No, well, what I'm saying is that H.C. Beck throughout and even today is saying that they are the general contractor and that FMR was the owner, unlike in Entergy, in which Entergy came in and says, hey, we're the general contractor.
That's what I'm saying. It's a preservation point, really, because they haven't argued that they're one and the same here.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
And from what Mr. Rice has said, and as adopted by the Court of Appeals, is, and on both of the grounds on which the Court of Appeals decided the case, that not only did there have to be a written agreement between the general contractor and the subcontractor, under which the general provided the workers' compensation insurance to the subcontractor, but as Mr. Rice inserted at any number of points in the briefing here, under which the general contractor obligated itself to provide the insurance. It's a crucial addition to the language of the statute that is not in the statute. The Court of Appeals seemed to be persuaded by it because what it seems to indicate is that there had to be an unconditional and guaranteed provision of this workers' compensation insurance to the subcontractor. That is not what the statute says.
Well, but you would think the statute contemplates that for an employer to get this benefit of being a deemed employer, they have to have done something real. They have to have given something for that in terms of providing workers' comp insurance. And if the alternate insurance clause allows Beck to do nothing if OSIP doesn't approve them for the program, then that doesn't really serve the purpose of the statute.
I disagree, Your Honor, that the, first of all, that the alternative insurance is crucial to the court's decision in this case. But in fact, of course, and even in the way that Mr. Rice is construing that alternative insurance provision, of course, we say that's not the proper construction of the alternative insurance provision. And it's page 641 of the clerk's record, paragraph 11.2 of the OSIP itself, which lays out what will happen in the event that the OSIP is excluded from the construction contract. And it says quite clearly, quite explicitly, that the construction manager, and that would be, it has to go out and purchase it.
I agree. I mean, I understand y'all disagree over the construction of that clause. If your opposing counsel's construction were the proper one, if the alternate insurance clause in the subcontract says in the event of an OSIP termination, subcontractor and lower tier subcontractors will be required to provide alternate insurance. And if that did require the sub to go out and get alternate insurance, not HC Beck, then what is Beck providing here? He's not providing a premium. He's not providing insurance.
I think that that would be the state of facts that would be presented upon the filing of the lawsuit, and it could very well be that Beck would not be entitled in that circumstance to the statutory immunity because it had, as a factual matter, not provided it. But the factual matter in this case and the state of the record is that it was provided. Every contract can be canceled. This is no different than any other contract with respect to the provision of workers' compensation insurance. So there's the alternative insurance provision is not really what ought to be focused on because it's this what-if circumstance. But what really counts, what really should matter, of course, is what did happen.
What I think I hear you saying is that if you did look at the contracts and you didn't look at what actually happened, if you looked at the obligations under the contracts, and if the alternate insurance provision is interpreted as opposing counsel says it should be, then you'd concede in that situation there'd be no provision by HC Beck. That's what I think you heard you say.
Because I think that Rice would be coming to court and saying that they're entitled to sue HC Beck because, and they're not entitled to statutory immunity because they went out and obtained the policy and they paid the premium. Now that's the look back at that point, whereas the look back that should govern the case is what was in force at the time.
Now let me ask you real quick: do you agree that Entergy versus Summers doesn't apply here?
Actually, as the Associated General Contractors amicus brief points out, that Entergy, in conjunction with the Court of Appeals decision in ET, could actually provide a second
letter
reason.
That, but no argument's been made here
there's a different configuration involved here.
There's no argument here that the owner acted as its own general contractor.
No, there's not.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
All rise.